Welcome to Office Hours with Adam Peterson, where I talk to business owners, employees, entrepreneurs and experts to find answers to those day-to-day questions about life and work in Luxembourg. If you have questions you'd like answered, let me know at adam.peterson@rtl.lu or on LinkedIn. But for now, on to today's show. So as an employee, I looked forward to it, but as a manager, I dreaded it. It was the performance management and appraisals. The big question I want to know is, how does it work in different industries? And here to help me today, I have from the law profession, Maria Pavelek, and an educational consultant, Kieran Dowling. So Maria, can you just introduce yourself for the listeners?
Yeah, sure. I'm Maria. I've lived in Luxembourg for the last 8 years, coming from Australia. As you've mentioned, I'm a lawyer and I came over here to work at a large international company. And I used to work at a very large law firm back in Australia.
Cool. And Kieran, your headline introduction, please.
Yes, thanks for having me. I'm Kieran. I'm originally from New Zealand and I've been working in the educational sector now for 25 years at a variety of big and some small international schools around the globe.
Thank you. So to start off with, most of my career, I've been exposed to the Force Ranking, which was pioneered by Jack Welch in General Electric, also called Rank and Yank. So at the start of the year, you set some objectives around safety, operational support, maybe process efficiency improvements. And at the end of the year, the managers rank every employee from top to bottom. And the idea is the top 20%, you give big bonuses, you reward them. The middle 70%, you kind of keep happy. And the bottom 10%, you either don't reward at all or you remove them. You yank them from the organization. So that's how it's worked there. Maria, how does it work in lawyers? What makes a good lawyer and in an in-house, a small and a larger firm? And how does the process differ or is it the same?
Yeah, so as I've mentioned, my experience is both at large organizations, so firms and in-house, and then I most recently at more smaller organizations. I found the processes for lawyers very similar in-house and at firms. If you're thinking about sort of the large international organizations, I think there's a very robust process. There's a questionnaire, like you've mentioned, sort of that you fill out, and there is fixed criteria. So for lawyers, as you can imagine, hard skills are important. So knowledge of the law. Are you giving the right advice to your client, whether that's your business client in-house or the client that's sort of paying you the big fees to receive advice.
So would that be kind of winning and losing cases? Would you be measured on that?
No, it's you know, like, and I'm talking here about lawyers, not partners in law firms, but the actual lawyers, you work in a team. And so it's really like how you're perceived in terms of your technical knowledge. Have you given the correct advice when you've given research? It's not really cases because a lot of lawyers don't do litigation per se.
But at the end of the year, would a lawyer know where they, are they ranked against each other? And they would know that they're in the top 20%, the middle 70, or the bottom 10, or
no, it's not. It's you're ranked or you're rated against a scale, and then so it's your manager or the partner that you work with that actually assigns sort of a rating of where you fall from a scale of 1 to 5. And in terms of whether you would know, I think that you know, you should be getting feedback on whether you're getting things right. So, you know, have you written an advice for a client that's correct, or has it come back red and white? Cool. That sort of thing.
So you wouldn't explicitly be told I'm a 5 and I'm a 4, and you wouldn't compare as colleagues afterwards on how you were?
You would be given a ranking sort of in each category during your review, but no, you wouldn't compare. So okay. It's not like a rank and yank, it's more of a bit of a subjective, I guess, scale.
So how do you do against a particular skill set?
Exactly, like do you have this? Like are okay. You know, it's almost like a grade at school. You know, it's exactly that.
And there would be nothing to stop all the lawyers getting all the top grades.
Correct.
That's good. So if it's a bit like a grade in school, so jumping to education, how does it work in teaching?
So similarly, actually dissimilarly, it's a soft skill. Teaching and education is really about students and student learning, and there's no measure where you can assess whether a teacher's reached a rank or reached a particular outcome. So in schools, majority of schools have an independent system that works for their school, but it's loosely based around a similar framework. There's a Mazzano framework or a Danielson framework where teachers and educators are evaluated, if you like, against four different domains. And so that's on the teaching, actual teaching, the hard skill, like you mentioned with law. Do you know education? Do you know your subject? Are you able to deliver that content so students can understand? Then there is the classroom environment and how it's more the soft skills and the relationships with students. There's the actual instruction, the actual pedagogy of teaching, and then finally general professionalism. So teachers usually set their own goals that then leaders and administrators assess them against at the end of the year.
So they would almost self-assess against those, or would they be told where they are against those by their?
I think it's a combination. For the most part, teachers are setting their own goals and self-assessing their performance using portfolios or other evidence. If a teacher is underperforming against the standards for what makes an excellent teacher, then they may be assessed against those by an administrator.
Okay, that makes sense. I think underperformance could be a whole nother episode, so we won't get too stuck into that for now. But in teaching how they self-assess, I guess it's not connected to compensation at all, is it?
Absolutely not.
And is it in law?
It is, and just to follow on from what Kieran said, like, we do actually have the soft skill criteria and the financial criteria as well. So there's the hard skill, soft skill, and financials, and then overall it is linked to performance, and then that's linked to a bonus and how much you get. Yeah, directly, very directly. In fact, you usually get an outline in part of the policy that clearly tells you that if you get X ranking, then you get a guaranteed bonus of, say, 20% and et cetera. And then sometimes there's also a discretionary bonus you can earn. But yeah, it's quite regulated, at least at the firms and companies I've been at.
Excellent. So in theory, we now have an idea of how it works in theory. So let's take a quick break. And when we'll come back, we'll talk about whether it actually works in practice. Evaluation and performance, merit rating or annual review. The idea of a merit rating is alluring. The sound of the words captivates the imagination. Pay for what you get what you pay for, motivate the people to do their best for their own good. The effect is exactly the opposite of what the words promise. These are the words of W. Edwards Deming, credited for helping Japan rebuild after the war and becoming a manufacturing powerhouse. So welcome back to Office Hours. And today we're talking about performance management and appraisals. In part one, we looked at how evaluations are done in different companies. And in part two, we'll look at how or whether they work. So with me are Maria Pavlik and Kieran Dowling. So annual appraisals, they're disease three of Deming's seven management diseases. He says they're a lottery. It's the system that drives performance, not the individual. And different individuals are dealing with different variables, like different classes of kids. So, Kieran, do you agree with Dr. Deming, or would you be in the Jack Welch camp?
I definitely agree. Teaching and education is wholly collaborative, and it really depends on the system, because as an individual classroom teacher, you don't know the makeup of your class. You don't get to decide the level of learning needs in your classroom. So if you were held accountable on a performance level for how your students succeed, there are just too many variables. And the fact that teaching as an art is so collaborative, teachers work together. You're never working in isolation. You're collaborating with your colleagues. You are co-teaching with a learning support or an English language teacher to support student needs. And so who would be held accountable when the system is so collaborative in nature?
Yeah, in the first half, I think we mentioned that most schools don't link compensation to ratings, but some do. Is that right? It's kind of a rare occurrence.
I think, personally, I've never worked in a school where it has been ranked, has been related to performance pay. I think it's a very small minority. And I think in fact, I don't know for a fact, but I think if they were based on performance pay, they would be looking at student data, student outcomes on assessments, on test scores. And as I explained earlier, that is so hard to be able to attribute to one individual teacher.
Yeah, because sometimes, I mean, I think we're all parents in the room. Sometimes your kids just decide to become more mature, right, and start to work, and it's not necessarily the teacher that's done that. It's just the kids started to work.
Absolutely, it's the whole education system. If you think about it, if a student's in school from kindergarten through grade 12, that's 13 years, and if they've had a wonderful path where they've achieved all of those outcomes as they should have developmentally, then great, the teacher that gets them in the next year has a relatively straightforward pathway to help that student succeed. But depending on what happened in previous years of education, if that student hasn't achieved what they needed to, then the teacher that has them has a far more challenging road ahead.
Yeah, absolutely. One thing as well, turn to Maria, a question of the lawyer. So Jack Welch, with his model, he thinks that 20% of his people are going to be motivated because they're rewarded, 70% are going to be neutral, and 10% upset. But there's this thing called a cognitive bias called illusory superiority, which is effectively best shown by 80% of the world think they're above average drivers, which isn't possible, right? Because only 50% can be. So people generally think they're better than they are. So Jack Welch thinks he's motivating people, but surely the top 20% are neutral anyway. And then the 80% who aren't in the top 20%, they're all upset. So it must demotivate them. I'd be worried about demotivating a bunch of lawyers who might want to litigate the performance management process itself. How does it work in law? How do people take the process?
I guess it depends on the person. And as you've pointed out, Adam, I guess it depends on where they're ranked. The top people are always happy. And I think the interesting things I've observed in law firms is it's not only the performance reviews, the tool that kind of send that message, because in law firms, a lot of the lawyers are dependent on the partners for work. And so throughout the year, you kind of notice who's getting the great transactions, the great cases, and the more interesting ones. And so I think generally you'll see that develop through the year. But you're right. Obviously, the people that are at the bottom are the disgruntled ones who don't get the bonus at the end of the year. And I think that's where you see attrition, which there's a term of intended and unintended attrition. And so the unhappy people then will generally move on to a different opportunity because, you know, lawyers are very competitive. We always want to get the top grades and we mostly think that we're doing well. I mean, we've always done well at school. So,
yeah, and I guess as lawyers, you'd be really good at keeping documented evidence to describe to someone whilst they're in the ranking they are. Otherwise, they'll come back with a reverse legal case to challenge their position in the rankings. Is that something that happens at all?
Look, it's very difficult. It's very difficult. I mean, it is subjective ratings, and also the legal industry is a very small industry. So I think, you know, by launching a case, and I think the same at banks at executive level or even junior, like if you sort of rattle the cage, I think there's a very big barrier. I don't think it's so easy to sue a firm for your performance ranking. So most people would just pack up and move on to a different opportunity.
Cool. So we touched there, I guess, on the cultural differences between lawyers. I'm probably putting some that may not actually be there. The cultural difference between lawyers and teachers and people in corporations. So one thing that actually, I guess, is really important, particularly in the Luxembourg context, where you have so many different people from different cultures and different nationalities coming together, that the way that the performance rating gets fed back to the employee is pretty important. Have you got any experience in your travels on that? So, Kieran, I think you've been in further east than Luxembourg.
I have indeed. I have been in schools in Asia and in the Middle East, and there are definitely cultural differences to take into account when giving feedback, and largely performance assessment, appraisals, and education is about the art of giving and receiving feedback. And actually, there are two really fabulous books, one called Tell Me So I Can Hear You, and the other is called Thanks for the Feedback. And both speak to the cultural differences and how, when you understand best how you give and how you like to receive feedback, you can also be able to ask the questions to the individual, to the employee, how do you like to receive feedback? There are certainly cultures who are very direct and appreciate the bare bones, the direct feedback, just tell me what I need to do to improve. And there are some that would be appalling, that would be so confronting. And you have to really find an artful path to navigate it in a lot of positive elements and get to the truth of what the teacher needs to do to improve.
I reckon that's probably similar to driving. I think it's one of those things where everyone thinks they're good at receiving feedback, but actually we're all pretty bad. The case, I remember I had a team and I'd go through performance appraisal time and I'd give people their ratings. And they would complain, say, oh, but you gave so-and-so got this and so-and-so got that. Why have you not given me this? And I'd say, well, I can't talk to you about someone else's performance, blah, blah, blah. I went to the next team. I'd give the rating. And they'd say, oh, thank you very much, and walk out. And I thought, oh, wow, I've become a brilliant manager. The reality was I'd moved from Scotland to a post-Soviet country. And it was just the difference where there's, I think, a bigger, I think they call it power differential, mm-hmm. where the culture is that you do not readily disagree with hierarchy, mm-hmm. whereas in Scotland they were pretty quick to disagree with me. Were there any more kind of cultural observations?
Yeah, look, I think in international organisations there's a lot of consciousness about that point. You know, there's even specific trainings for managers to make sure that you're aware. And speaking of books, Karen, there's a book called the Culture Map, mm-hmm. which actually talks about how to navigate that. And, you know, to be more conscious around if you're operating in an international environment or maybe in a different culture where you're not used to, like being conscious of how people hear it. Because ultimately, as a manager, if you're a good manager, what you're wanting to see is for people to grow and improve.
Yeah, one of those popped up in my LinkedIn feed the other day, how I think it was British and Dutch, and how the British say it and the Dutch perceive it. And the British person was kind of, I'm very disappointed in that. And the Dutch person thought, oh, cool, not very bad. Where it's like the biggest insult you could get from an English person is to say they're disappointed. I didn't mind when my mum shouted at me, but when my mum told me she was disappointed, that's when I went and hid under my duvet. Could another bit, I just want to compare and contrast between your two careers industries is the point of picking up on linking to compensation. Now, I don't really think that it's a particularly good idea. If I think about it, someone may get a difference between being top ranked and not top ranked, maybe a couple of percent on their base salary, which is probably a couple of thousand euros a year, which is maybe like 10 euros a day. When I'm writing a report or doing a piece of work, I'm not thinking I'm going to do a good job on this report because I got paid, I got a good rating, and I'm getting an extra 10 euros today for it. I want to do a good report. That's what I want to do. Surely teachers want to be good teachers because they want to be good teachers, right?
Absolutely.
And lawyers, surely you want to do, you know, you didn't necessarily pick law for the money, you picked it because it's a trade that you enjoy and you like the process of law. So do you think it needs to be linked to compensation?
Look, I think it doesn't. I think it's common, and in law you not only link it to sort of the ranking but also your financial performance, like in a law firm how many hours you bill and your billing performance rate. So there's a real link about the revenue for the firm versus your performance. I mean, does it need to be? No, but it's also used really as a tool, like a performance management tool. So the bonus is used to keep people happy, but also to send a message to the people who aren't performing that, hey, you know, like you're not performing at the right level. So either you improve your performance or those who are really underperforming, it's sort of like a natural attrition, I think is the term for it.
Okay, that sounds good. Good. So we're fairly close to running out of time. So we've talked about some interesting books there. We'll make sure we get the links to the books in the show notes for the podcast or the radio show. But we've got a lot. Any last thoughts, Kieran, on the topic?
I don't think so. I think.
And how can people get in contact with you if they want to hear more of your thoughts?
They can reach out to me on LinkedIn, or they can, look me up. All my details actually are on LinkedIn.
Maria?
I think, you know, a typical lawyer comment at the end is performance tools are also a way the companies can use to protect themselves. So having like a proper, robust performance process that's well recorded is, really important from that perspective. In terms of getting in touch with me, just like Karen, like it's LinkedIn. So it's Pawelek, Maria.
Okay, and it's for Kieran, it's Keryn.
That's right.
I don't think I've ever heard a more lawyer comment than Marie's last one, but that's brilliant. Thank you very much. I think for myself, I think I'm not in the Welsh camp. I don't think Welsh's idea works well. I'm not actually in the Deming camp either. I do think that performance management process is worth having, but I do think it needs to be done right. And I think companies can make a really big difference if they get it right. So all that's left for me to say thank you for my guests. Thank you to the listeners. And we'll speak to you soon. So that's it for today's episode. If you have feedback and questions on this topic or any other, drop me a line at adam.peterson@rtl.lu or on LinkedIn.